Well, good morning. It's great to see you all here. It's also great to see some good friends here today. We've got some church family members that have returned to us again. We have some people that were gone and you didn't even know it. So those of you who have been vacationing and are back, it's great to see you all here as well. Pastor John is off this week, and so I have the privilege to preach today. And believe it or not, we have come close to the end of our study of Joseph. We have this week, and then we have next week, and Mark is going to wrap up the Joseph series. Who has enjoyed Joseph this summer? Yes. What an amazing story. And there are so many stories in the Bible, but Joseph, if you actually look from a volume perspective at how many chapters Joseph takes in Genesis, that's a big story. And so obviously holds a lot of weight in terms of what God can teach us from that story. I did want to say thank you to Pastor Ron. I don't see him here, but Pastor Ron put the Connections booklet together this year and put that study together for us. And I think actually that's probably about the 14th year that he has done that. So if you happen to see him, let him know that you appreciate that effort, because without it, we wouldn't have the Connections study. I also wanted to say thank you to those who have hosted Connections Bible studies in their backyard this summer. So that's one of those things that kind of is unique to our church and one of those events that I think we all look forward to if we're able to participate. So thank you to the hosts, and also thank you to the facilitators. Sometimes they're the same people, sometimes they trade off and we'll have a different host and a different facilitator leading us through. God, we have already been reminded this morning in the music and the words that we have sung that it is all about you. And that regardless of the circumstances we find ourselves in, you are in control and you continue to be the same God day after day after day. And as we look at the story of Joseph, we see that continually demonstrated that you are God and you are sovereign. So God, as we look at this story of how you have worked through an incredible period of history with some pretty neat people, I ask that you would open our eyes to see the things that we need to be reminded of, maybe learn something new about, or just be prepared to apply to our lives. God, we're not here just to fill some time. We're here to meet you, to be taught by you, and to be changed by you. And so we ask that you would work through me as I offer myself as a tool for you to use, glorify yourself as we study your word this morning together. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, you'll recall that the whole story of Joseph really starts with Jacob. So Jacob is the son of Isaac, the grandson of Abraham, which was where that phrase, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, comes from. He has 12 sons. Now, those 12 sons really will form the basis and foundation for the Jewish nation, because called Israel. And actually, funny enough, Jacob's name is also Israel. So the 12 tribes of Israel really are descendants of Jacob's 12 sons. Now, unlike most fathers, at least I hope this is the case, Jacob had a favorite son. And that favorite son's name was Joseph. And we probably know a bit about him, even if we're not familiar with the biblical text. We're familiar because Hollywood has kind of picked up on this story, and we have Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and we have all sorts of things that we're familiar in our culture about this story. But we're going to dig in a little deeper here. So Joseph is the favorite son of Jacob, and of course that fact alone is enough to set Joseph apart as kind of the most hated of all the people in the family. Joseph's brothers hate that fact, that he is their father's favorite. Well, maybe to make things worse, Joseph happens to get some cool clothes from his dad that, again, set him apart. And Joseph has this annoying little habit of having dreams and then telling everybody about them. And the brothers really don't like that either. And they really just, they are looking for a way to get rid of Joseph. So when the opportunity arises, the brothers take teen Joseph. They ambush him, and they ultimately sell him to slave traders who are heading to Egypt. Over the span of about 15 years, Joseph goes through all sorts of experiences, including being accused of a false crime, or falsely accused of a crime, thrown into prison, and then by some incredible work of God, taken out of prison and raised to the most powerful position in all of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. One of Joseph's key responsibilities in this position was to prepare the country and manage it through a period of 7 years of prosperity, followed by 7 years of famine. And if you remember some of the passages that we have looked at earlier this summer, you'll remember that God gave Pharaoh dreams about this, about the cows and the corn ears, and actually it was Joseph, with help from God, who explained those dreams to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh, in turn, put Joseph in control of the country. During the 7 years of prosperity, Joseph gathered a portion of all of the harvest that was bountiful. It was incredible. Egypt had never seen anything like this before. And he took a portion of that and stored it so that when the 7 years of famine came, Egypt had food. So during the second year of this famine, which is where we're going to kind of start today, Joseph is operating the largest famine relief program in the known world. That's a pretty incredible amount of responsibility. It's also during this time that Joseph's story takes quite an incredible turn. Because the famine isn't isolated just to Egypt, Joseph's brothers arrive from Canaan to buy food for their families. Joseph recognizes them, but they don't recognize him. See, he was a teenager when they got rid of him, and now he's a man. And not only is he a man, he's dressed like an Egyptian. And he doesn't let on at all that he knows who they are. And so, as they bow down before Joseph, unknowingly fulfilling that prophetic dream that he had about them bowing down, Joseph decides to do the whole border security thing on them and accuses them of being spies. Well, of course they protest, but he doesn't listen and he throws them in prison and 3 days later says, okay, I'm going to give you a chance. So I'm going to keep one of your brothers here. Simeon stays with me in prison. You go home and you get that other brother you say you have and you bring him to me, and then I'll believe you that you aren't spies looking for ways to exploit my country of Egypt. They needed to bring Benjamin back, not only to prove that they weren't spies, but to procure Simeon's release. And this is where the story gets painful, especially if you're a father. Because as Jacob sees his sons coming back from Egypt, they have food, but they don't have Simeon. And as the brothers start to explain to him about this guy who was really mean to them and he kept Simeon and he's demanding that we bring Benjamin back, Jacob is beside himself. Benjamin is the other son of his favorite wife. Another thing I hope you guys aren't doing. Well, maybe you should have a favorite wife because you have one and she should be your favorite. But he didn't want to lose Benjamin either because he had never really gotten over losing Joseph. And then as the brothers open their sacks, they see the money that they were supposed to use to pay for the grain that they had just brought. So now, they've also stolen from that man. What's Jacob going to do? Jacob says, "You are not taking Benjamin. I will not lose another son. I've lost Joseph. I've lost Simeon. Now you're saying I need to lose Benjamin? There is no way." And yet, this famine is so bad that the interpretation of Pharaoh's dreams is that the 7 years of famine are so bad, you'll forget all about the 7 years of prosperity. food runs out. Jacob's hand is forced. He has no choice. He's got to send his sons back to Egypt in order that they won't all die. So he sends Benjamin along. They come back to Joseph. Simeon is released from prison, and as they bow down in front of Joseph, Joseph sees Benjamin and has to deal with the emotions of seeing his little brother after all these years, and throws a party, throws a banquet, which seems like a kind of a weird thing, because this guy was really mean before. Now he's feeding us. But one of the fun facts about this particular story is Joseph freaks out his brothers by sitting them in birth order. How does this guy know? That's a little weird. But not only that, Benjamin gets 5 times the amount of meal that everybody else does, and that just is, that's keeping the brothers on edge. In a final and gut-wrenching test, Joseph again sends the brothers back to Canaan, filling their food sacks with grain, and again putting their money, which, by the way, they've now brought double, because they need to pay for the first round of food, and they brought money for the second round of food. He puts both rounds of money back in their food sacks. But on top of that, he has one of his servants put his special personal silver cup in Benjamin's bag. And off they go. And as they leave Egypt, Joseph sends his men after them to look, and stops them and says, "Something's missing." And they search all of the luggage, and of course they find the money, but they don't care about the money, it's the personal silver cup. And so they drag everybody back, and by this point, the brothers just must be on the edge of terror. This is what Jacob didn't want to happen, because this mean man says that whoever has my cup, I will keep him as my slave forever. And the brothers are just beside themselves. Back in front of Joseph, the brothers plead for mercy, and Judah leads that pleading by offering himself as a slave in Benjamin's place. That catches us up to today's passage in chapter 45 and 46. An incredible passage, an incredible part of the story where I think finally, in out of just sheer relief, Joseph finally reveals himself to his brothers and says, "Guys, it's me." Now, you'd think that maybe that would be received really well. But these brothers are, their minds are blown. Maybe they didn't say that then, but that's kind of the effect. This mean man is our brother, Joseph, the one we sold, the one we listened to crying and calling and asking us not to do these terrible things and selling him to the slave traders. And this is the guy, and now he's the most powerful person in all of Egypt, and he holds our lives in his hands. That must have been absolutely horrific. Well, Joseph, in just a sheer and incredible amount of grace and mercy and forgiveness, comforts his brothers and says, "Go back, get your families, get Jacob, our father, and bring them here. And you guys will live here in Egypt. I have everything you will ever need." That did bring some relief, but I think that relief probably to the brothers disappeared as they were going back to Jacob, knowing that all of a sudden this burden, this issue, this sin that they had committed against Joseph and that they'd lied about to their father, it's going to come out. They have got to explain to Jacob what has happened and why it's happened and why they found Joseph in Egypt. And that isn't going to be easy. The Connections group on Wednesday night looked at chapters 45 and 46 and discussed some of the key elements of the story itself. And so what I'd like to do is I want to look at 3 key truths that we can pull out of the text for today. So I would invite you to turn to Genesis 45 and have it handy as we look at 3 key elements: the plan, the purpose and the perspective. Have you ever thought about what Joseph had planned for his life when he was a young teen? I mean, he probably just assumed that he would continue to learn the family business of raising livestock, that he'd find a nice Jewish girl, that he'd get married, that he'd have his own family, that he'd raise his own livestock, and that he'd live with his full extended family as God's covenant people. Simple, comfortable, attainable, and not to be. I think Joseph was a planner. I get that fact because he clearly has the gifts of administration and management and leadership. He had the ability to deal with short-term issues and long-term goals. He could see the big picture and likely had contingency plans for every part of his life. Every place God put him, he would just jump right in and all of a sudden start running the operations to the point where his overseers didn't even check his work. He was that good. I wonder if Joseph had ever been his father's operations manager. And as one of the youngest of the brothers, I wonder if maybe that also had something to do with their hatred towards him. I do think Joseph was a planner, but his plans weren't God's. We all like to plan. We like to plan our lives to some extent or another. We all expect that we are going to do certain things that we have planned throughout our lives, and we think our plans are the best. After all, we came up with them. They're our plans, and therefore our life, so why not? But when our plans start to bump against the plans of God, we start to get a little antsy about that. And maybe we start to question God. God, why? What's going on? What's the problem here? I had a plan for my life, one that I truly believed was from God, and one that I pursued for a number of years. And as I saw the doors slamming in my face every time I pursued that plan, which, by the way, I asked God to do, if this wasn't His will, please make it obvious, and He did, but instead of acknowledging that, I started to blame Him. I started to say, God, why are You messing this up? You have clearly given me this plan. You have clearly given me this passion to fulfill this plan in my life. So why do You continue to fail delivering over and over and over? There are plenty of opportunities for You, but You're not doing it. And then, finally, God pointed out to me that His plan for my life was actually not His plan. It was my plan. I had just taken my plan and blamed Him for it. Really wanted it so bad that this has got to be God's will. This has got to be what He wants for me. But I had gotten it wrong. I had just convinced myself that my plan was His. When we look at the passage in Genesis 45, I like how Joseph spells out to his brothers that it wasn't even their plan that brought him to Egypt. Take a look at chapter 45, verse 8. So Joseph is in that discussion with his brothers, and he says to them, "So then, it was not you who sent me here." Because, by the way, he's reminded them by then that I'm the one that you sold into Egypt. "But it's not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household, and ruler of all of Egypt." Now, there are a couple of things I think we can pull out here. The first one is that God's plans are superior to ours. Isaiah 55:9 says that God tells us, "As the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." Well, that makes sense. God's a creator of the universe, so any plans that He has are just going to be better. And no matter how good our plans are, no matter even how righteous our plans are, God's plans are superior. In fact, so much so that James 4 reminds us that even as you are planning, be sure to acknowledge that God's will is preeminent in your lives. We should therefore stop being surprised that God diverts us sometimes from what we think should be happening. Second thing that I would say is that God will not be derailed while accomplishing his will. Joseph reminds his brothers that while they did sell him into slavery in Egypt, which is bad, God used that to get Joseph into the right place at the right time, which is good. Isn't that encouraging? So no matter what the circumstances are, God will accomplish what he has set out to do. And in a world that seems to be falling apart at the seams, it's amazingly encouraging to be reminded that nothing will stop God. And in fact, Proverbs records, "Many are the plans in a person's heart, but it is the Lord's purposes that prevail." This brings us to purpose. Our feelings, our experiences, our plans, all of those things really are what we spend most of our time on. Our attention is continually pulled to our circumstances. But circumstances are only part of the big picture. If God is continually orchestrating our circumstances to accomplish this will, his will, then what is his purpose? Well, what's the purpose for Joseph's life? Let's look in chapter 45, verse 5. Back to Joseph, talking to his brothers. "And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." There it is. There's the purpose. And isn't it just like God to have a purpose for the plan? He will not waste a decision. He will not waste a moment in time. Now, I bet, even though it's not recorded, that Joseph asked that why question probably quite a lot. "God, why do my brothers hate me so much? Why did they sell me as a slave? Why do I keep getting accused of doing wrong things when all I keep doing are the right things?" But just because we don't know why something happens doesn't mean that God doesn't have a purpose. And here's something else that's kind of interesting about this part of the story. In Genesis 46, we find God affirming to Jacob, the father, that he should pack up his entire family and go to Egypt as Joseph has requested. Well, why was Jacob nervous? Wouldn't you think that Jacob would be jumping at the opportunity to see this son that he thought he had lost so many years before? And not only that, to save his family from ultimate destruction because there's just nothing left to eat in Canaan. Well, maybe it's because of something God had said to his grandfather Abraham. Genesis chapter 15 says this. God is talking to Abraham as they're discussing God's covenant with him. And the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions." Now we all know, because we have the full story, that God was alluding to the fact that the Israelites would be slaves in Egypt for 400 years. I don't think Jacob knew that, but I think maybe he wondered, because he would have known about that promise, because they would have passed that down. The grandfather, Abraham, would have told Isaac and then Jacob about the promise. Be careful not to go anywhere weird, because you might end up being slaves, and God said it's going to be for a really long time. But look what the conversation continues in chapter 46. So if you look at chapter 46, verse 3, God says this to Jacob. "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there." Now that to me sounds like another purpose. But I thought that the purpose of Joseph's life was to save his family from the famine. Well, it was. But see, God is an infinite God. And he can have more than one thing going on. He's not limited by linear thinking. He is capable of an infinite number of purposes for an infinite number of events over an infinite period of time and space, or just simply put, he's capable of having more than one purpose. There's a show on Home and Garden Television where One of their more popular handymen is building a house. And so he and his wife, both very accomplished, expert construction, tradespeople, designers, etc., are building this dream home from the ground up. Now, you don't have to watch any episode for very long until you see what the inevitable thing happens. And that is that that can't be done before that. And by the way, that's delayed because of that thing over there. See, this project, which is linear in nature, which should be step one, step two, step three, turns into step one, then three, five, after nine, if eight gets done under budget and on time. And that's just the construction part. That doesn't take into account at all the errors that happen, the modifications, the changes. And you can just see as the show goes on, the stress begins to mount, because no matter how good you are, you just can't get every aspect of every plan and every dependency as they collide together. It's just not possible. But with God, there's no constraint. He can do all of those things all at once. And so that's what we see here. Now, before we get too comfortable thinking, okay, now we know what the plan for Joseph was, we need to look at one more thing. Chapter 45, verse 7. Again, Joseph, talking to his brothers, says this, "But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." Now, for anyone who studies the Bible, the word remnant will jump out. Technically, a remnant is a leftover portion of a larger whole that is used most often in a negative context as being a worthless piece of scrap of whatever we're talking about. And yet, God puts high value on the remnant. And He uses this word throughout Scripture to identify those of His people who He has set aside for a specific purpose. If God had not acted as He did in this story, His entire covenant with Abraham would have disintegrated. Abraham's descendants were promised. Abraham himself was promised that his descendants would be made into a great nation that would number more than the stars. And yet, that great nation would come from these 12 sons of Jacob, who would become the 12 tribes of Israel. And if they're about to die, because they're in the middle of this incredible famine. As human history progressed, God would maintain a remnant of His people through all sorts of incredible situations. Joseph's life may be a small speck in Jewish history on a human scale, but for God's purpose, it was a very critical part. This discussion about the remnant brings us to our final point, and that's perspective. Have you ever had a conversation or an email exchange with a family member or maybe someone at the church or a friend, and they said something that really made you defensive, and you really were kind of put out? And so you'd go to them and you would really to give them a piece of their mind, but as you talked about it, they would explain what they meant, they would explain the background as to why they said what they did, and then all of a sudden that anger would just dissolve because it made sense. And in fact, what was the offending comment really wasn't so offensive, and in fact, it actually was quite legitimate. And so you moved on from there because you understood what was going on. Perspective is defined as a point of view, an attitude towards or a way of looking at something. And it's a powerful element in our human experience. Oh, by the way, did you wonder why I came back here? Many of you right now are probably thinking, I should be up there, not back here. Some of you might actually be annoyed that I'm not where I'm supposed to be. Some of you are curious as to why I'm back here, but don't really know how to find out what's going on. Some of you refuse to turn around and look to see, period. You are not playing this game at all. No matter what your perspective, no matter what the real reason is, or no matter what you're thinking right now, your perspective has changed. It impacts how you are processing what is going on. My message hasn't changed. I'm following exactly what I had planned here, and yet your perspective of what I'm doing certainly has. God's perspective is infinite. He sees the really big picture. He could see that Joseph going to Egypt would bring Jacob and his entire family to Egypt, and that in 400 years, the entire nation of Israel would be slaves. He knew that the Pharaoh of that time period would need some convincing to let the Israelite people go. He knew that he was going to send the angel of death. He knew that the only way to be saved from that angel of death was the blood on the doorposts of people's homes from the first Passover lambs. God also knew that the Israelites would celebrate Passover for the next 1,600 years, and that everyone who heard would understand John the Baptist's declaration about Jesus when he said, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Not only that, but God knew that Jesus' death on the cross would fulfill a promise made to Adam and Eve 2,000 years before Joseph. His perspective is infinite. God knew it because he orchestrated it all, and he knew it because he has no limit in his perspective. Well, that's great. Like that, all that really does is just tells us that God knows everything and we don't. There's nothing different there, right? Well, how is that encouraging to us? How do we apply that to our lives? Well, here is my challenge for you today. If you believe that God was watching out for Joseph in this story and taking care of him despite all of the circumstances that were going on, if you believe that God, through his plan, accomplished his purpose in Joseph's life, if you believe that God included Joseph in a plan so big that Joseph didn't even know about it, and if this God is the same God today as in Joseph's time, shouldn't we be able to acknowledge that God can do the exact same things for us? And if you acknowledge that God can do the exact same things for us, doesn't that change our perspective on life? Joseph put God at the center of his life and trusted him through every situation, whether he understood it or not. If you do the same, you can know for certain that no matter the circumstances, God is still trustworthy, still capable, and is directing you for a purpose.